Good afternoon. We'll call this meeting of the Jobs and Energy Conference Committee to order. We're going to pick up where we left off yesterday, and we're going to begin with side-by-side overviews of Article 3. And first of all, for anyone who's wondering, I apologize for my more casual attire today, but the last two times I wore this shirt, the Wild won. So I'm wearing it today, and if it works, I suspect I'll be wearing it for quite a few more days. So,
Mr. Chair, you are washing it?
What's that?
You are washing it, right?
Yes, I will be, in addition to watching it, I'll be attending, so.
No, washing it.
Washing it. Oh, they said watching it. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. What, does not washing it help the luck of your team or something?
Well, that's the way they say it is. I also, Senator Thompson doesn't want the smell, I don't think, either.
Okay. Very good. Okay, so we're going to start off in at Article 3, and please begin.
Mr. Chair and members of the Conference Committee, Anita Newman from the House Research Department. Article 3, we're starting on page R1. It's House Section 1 and Senate Section 1 from a separate Senate file that passed off the Senate floor. This is a virtually identical provision that deals with manufactured home parks, and it removes the requirement that vehicles be parked at least 10 feet from the nearest home. The House bill on page R2 does have a effective date, the day following final enactment. The next provision is at the bottom of page R2, going over to page R3. It's a House-only provision, and it deals with the Economic Development and Housing Challenge Program, and it requires that the funds for this be divided equally between the metro and the non-metro. On page R3, going over to page R4, is a House Section 3. This is, again, House-only language dealing with the Met Council, and it requires that the legislature give approval of the Met Council's development guide provisions that are related to housing. Page R4 again, Section 4, a House-only provision that deals with affordable life cycle goals, and it requires that the negotiated affordable and life cycle housing goals for each metropolitan municipality be submitted to the legislature for approval, and provides that the Met Council can adopt the goals only if the legislature approves them or if the legislature adjourns without acting on them. On page R5, House Section 6 authorizes the legislature to act on the Met Council's affordable life cycle housing opportunities amounts. If no legislative action is taken, the council can then go ahead with its proposed amounts.
On Mr. Chair and members of the Conference Committee, Carlin Fontaine, Senate Counsel, on page R5, there are Section 6 on the House side and Section 25 on the Senate side. These are two almost identical provisions. I believe I know that the House or the Senate added this on the floor as a floor amendment, and I believe the House also added it as a floor amendment. And this would allow the County Board of Olmsted County to serve as the Housing and Redevelopment Authority. And the only difference is that the House refers to it as an HRA, and the Senate just spells that out as a Housing and Redevelopment Authority.
Are there any questions on Article 3? Seeing none, let's continue to Article 4.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 4, page R1, Section 1 of the House is a provision that would change where the excess surplus from the assigned risk fund goes, and instead of dropping it to the budget reserve account in the general fund, it would go to safety grants that would be administered by the Commissioner of Labor and Industry. Page R2 is a House Section 2 and Senate Section 2, but the Senate has it in the Higher Education Omnibus Bill. These are the competency standards for dual training to be developed by the Commissioner of Labor and Industry. The provisions are quite similar. The House has the Commissioner of Labor and Industry consult with the Commissioner of Deed, and the Senate has the Commissioner of Dolly consult with the Office of Higher Education. And there's minor language differences in some of the international standards and that.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair and members, that Senate also, they added some language on line 48.25 on the Senate side regarding what the duties of the commissioner, that they should include awareness of disenfranchised communities in the metropolitan area. That was added as an amendment in the Jobs Committee.
Page R3, House Section 3, and over to page R4. And R5 is the language that provides for a minimum wage for tipped employees. On page R4 at the top, this provision also strikes the language dealing with a separate minimum wage for some summer work travel exchange visitor program workers that are under the J visa. The minimum wage language is at the bottom of page R4, beginning at line 73.1 and running over into R5 through line 73.20, where it defines what a tipped employee is, and that's a person that regularly receives more than $30 a month in gratuities. And then there is language on line 73.16 to 73.20 that provides that if the Minnesota Department of Human Rights makes three or more probable cause determinations of sexual harassment regarding a single employer, then the dual wage doesn't apply to that employer. The next provision is on page R6, House Section 4, and this requires that gratuities that are paid via a credit card or some other debit card have to, the full amount of the gratuity is payable to the employee. House Section 5 provides for this, a statewide minimum wage. It prohibits a local government minimum wage that is different from the state wage. Page R7, Section 6 is a uniformity of private employer benefit mandates.
Beginning on page R8, the Senate and House both have a fire sprinkler prohibition in law. They're worded a little differently. I think the mandatory fire sprinkler language on the Senate side is what has been carried in the past, and it may have been a little more refined on the House side. Then moving on page R8, and for a little ways in the bill, are some governor's items that came from the governor's bill and the Dolly recommendations. These first few provisions would put on hold for a couple of years some of the license increases and changes the license fees within Dolly for the various licenses they have there. So that's continue on page 8 and 9. And then also over on to page R10, his language is the same on sections 9 and sections 3 in the House and Senate. This is also reducing a few of the fees for a couple of years within Dolly. So that's R10 over to R11. But beginning on R11, section 10 on the House side and section 4 on the Senate side, these are similar. There are a few changes. This is a provision regarding the six-year cycle for the construction codes. And this would change it to a six-year review cycle for that. And going over to page R12, it looks like there are just maybe too many commas on the Senate side or some comma differences, so we can probably get those worked out. And
Mr. Chair, I would also point out that on the House language, I think, was identical to the Senate language, and we amended that in committee, but there was an engrossing problem when this bill was put together, and so only a part of that amendment came through. So we have, for example, on line 7932, And 7931 requiring an affirmative positive determination, and that really we weren't trying to be double careful. We just positive was supposed to have come out of there, and it didn't. So
then on page R12 on section 5 on the Senate side, there is a provision for the Dolly to provide free copies of the code. On page 13 is another same provision for the effective date of rules. It is moving it out to 270 days after publication of the rules notice of adoption in the state register for the state building code.
And on that same page, the House section 12, this actually goes with the House position on the fire sprinklers, requiring a contractor to offer any prospective customer the option to install fire sprinklers and any kind of fire sprinkler system components. And it requires an agreement to be signed and dated by the licensee and the customer.
And members, I wanted to mention that this provision, it is included in the state government finance bill in Senate file 888, the Senator Saxog, so that we are carrying that in the Senate, but it's in a different, the state government bill. In the side by side.
Chairman. Ms. Doyle, Fontaine and me. But are you talking about lines 80.27 to 80.31?
Yes, the section 12 of the House language of the written contract required, it appears in the side by side in the state government finance bill.
Please continue.
Page R13, the bottom of House section 13 and Senate section 7, going over to page R14, they are the same provisions dealing with boiler licensing and fees. On the bottom of page R14, House section 15 and Senate section 9, this continues through R15 and on to R16. They are the same provisions dealing with combative sports licenses and fees. Then page R16, House section 16 and Senate section 15 both deal with assigned risk transfers, but they are relatively different provisions.
Okay.
The House language on line 83.22 on page R16 cancels any further transfers from the assigned risk fund to the 21st Century Minerals Fund.
And I was going to say, on the Senate side, this is language that was suggested by MMB to actually allow the transfers, the appropriations to be available until June 30th of 2018.
And then on page R17, the House language on lines 84.7 to 84.15 strikes the current law language that would continue to transfer assigned risk money for workers' compensation reform. It was the DRG, the diagnostic related group issue that was enacted last year. And then the House language on pay on line 84.16 to 84.21 transfers the any outstanding balances back to the general fund rather than back to the assigned risk plan. House section 17 is the repealer section. The repealer of section 177.24 subdivision 2 is the current law provision that prohibits the use of gratuities in the calculation of the minimum wage. The reference to laws 2014 chapter 312 article 2 section 15 is the appropriation of the assigned risk money to the Commissioner of Labor and Industry for the DRG workers' compensation reform. And the Minnesota rules repealer of part 5205.0580 subpart 21 is the man lifts.
Questions on Article 5? Seeing none, we'll continue. That was Article 4, excuse me. Now we're on to Article 5. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the conference committee, on page R1, there are two provisions that were included in the Department of Commerce's budget bill, and these are provisions relating to the Guaranteed Energy Savings Program. and they would allow them to fix some fees and to create a special account for the Guaranteed Energy Savings Platform account.
Section 1 on the bottom of R1 is a house-only provision that authorized the deposit of money from the automobile theft prevention account into the insurance fraud prevention account. On R2, House Section 2 and Senate Section 3 are similar provisions dealing with administrative penalties for insurance fraud. There actually is, I think it's a drafting error in both bills. It's lines 85.17 and 85.18 on the House side and 177.19 and 177.20 on the Senate side. If the value is exactly $500, there isn't a penalty language that covers that. So I think we would need to, for example, on line 85.17 of the House language, we would strike after obtained is less than 500 and say it's not more than 500. So that it's just a technicality, but there is that out. And then there was additional language added on the House floor on lines 85.3 to 85.24 that the recovery amounts could exclude expenses and litigation costs, reasonable attorney fees, and interest.
And the Senate does have a different effective date, you see at the bottom of page R2 for this section.
Page R3, House Section 2, deals with the GAP, the Guaranteed Asset Protection Waivers, and it provides for the regulation or oversight of those waivers. And again, actually, there's on page 86.10, I think there is a typo in there that 4 should be from. And this provides, these GAP waivers are agreements that a creditor will waive all or a portion of the finance agreement if a vehicle is stolen or totaled, and that provides for a separate charge for that. And that language continues through page R4 to, through the balance of page R4 and R5, and on to R6. And through R7, lines 90.22, and that's the regulation of these GAP waivers.
On page R7, we have a couple of sections that are Senate only. Section 4, this the new language on lines 178.7 to 178.9 would exclude salaries from being included in these expenses. For the insurers would have to pay for their commissioners' participation in supervisory colleges. In Section 5, it goes with an insurance fraud bill. There are some other sections in this bill, and it's the right to consult with counsel for a person who's been in settlement and a claimant of an accident. And on page R8, this is there's a Senate and House provision in Sections 10 and Section 6, and the language is the same, and this also relates to the insurance fraud sections. There is a little a different effective date, though, on the Senate side.
Page R8, House Section 11, which continues over to page R9, this is language that transfers. Under current law, $1.3 million per year of the automobile theft prevention special revenue account money goes to the general fund. This language would transfer that to the insurance fraud protection account.
And on the bottom of page R9 is a section on this is a section regarding prohibitions on insurers for steering of toward a particular motor vehicle repair shop and using a particular electronic estimating system in auto insurance claims, collision claims. And on page, beginning on page R10, there's a number of pages that are dealing with the MinVest registration exemption. This is the crowdfunding bill. And that can, the language on R10, it provides definitions and provides the exemption requirements and definitions of the portal operator. Page R10, R11. And on R12, there are a couple of differences on what the amounts, the limitations for MinVest offerings. On line 94.7 and on 181.14, the House would allow the to be $5 million of earnings. I believe that's what the filings that are included, and it's $2 million on the Senate side. And then on 94.15 and 181.21 on the Senate side, it's $2 million and then $1 million on the Senate side. And on R13, the language is the same. And R14 also is the same on both the House and Senate. R15 is the same. R16 is the same for the acknowledgement and the portal information. R17 for the portal operators is the same. R18 language is the same. R19, R20, the only differences on those lines are on the House side on 101.22, it refers to a state agency, and on the Senate side in a couple of places it's referring to a state administrator. And the same is on R21, the House or Senate uses language referring to a state administrator, for example, on line 189.23, 190.5, and 190.18. And as I understand it, the Senate language was perhaps a little more, came a little further along and was worked on. So I believe that the state administrator language is what is the most current language. And that continues over to page R22. And there, again, we're also mentioning or using the language on 190.24 for the state administrator or their staff, and then also includes an effective date. Section 9 on page R22 is also relating to the crowdfunding bill, the MinVest, and this relates to the whether or not the records are public for a portal operator. And that, then on page R23, this section 10, this was included in the department's budget bill and relates to the petroleum fund, and would allow, this section would allow now to allow some costs to be reimbursed, including when the tank was, when the removal was requested or ordered by the commissioner as necessary for corrective action under this chapter. Page R24, that goes over to page R24, and there's some language regarding the effective date, including tank removal costs previously denied payment by the board. On page R24, section 11, this is some language on lines 193.5 to 193.7. This would expand the purposes for the project purposes for the innovative energy project. Page R25, this was also included in the Commerce's budget bill, section 12 at the top. This would remove the sunset date for this assessment to allow continuation of the assessment to be collected.
On page R25, House Section 13 begins the language that deals with voice over internet protocol service and internet protocol enabled services. Section 13 provides a definition of the OIP. Section 14 is the definition of internet protocol enabled service. Section 15, which begins on 25 and goes over to 26, provides for the regulation or non-regulation of the OIP or IP-enabled service in general, and provides that on R26, beginning on line 104.16, the regulation is generally prohibited except as allowed under federal law, that VOIP is subject to the surcharges for 9/11 services, the Telecommunication Access Minnesota, which is the services for disabled persons, and the Telephone Assistance Plan, which is the low-income component. On the bottom of R26, beginning on page 105, or line 105.11, provides for the exemptions of IP-enabled services that are not regulated, and that includes the video services provided by cable companies, cable service, and any other IP-enabled video service. On page R27, House Section 16 is the movement of $1.3 million to the insurance fraud prevention account.
On page R27, sections 13 and 14 come from the same bill that would expand regulation for to include persons engaged in the business in a business the principal purpose of which is collection of any debt. So this would expand the regulation as a collection agency for those types of persons.
And the House has this language in a separate bill, House File 368, authored by Representative Hillstrom. House Section 17, beginning on the bottom of R27 and going over to R28, is the provision for abandoned property, which provides that the list of abandoned property and persons has to be published on the Commerce website site. In a newspaper publication, and a list has to be provided every year to legislators. Page R28, the section 19 over to page R29 is dealing with accident victim solicitation, and it prohibits anyone who contacts an individual cannot provide false or deceptive or misleading information, can't directly or indirectly offer any inducement to use a professional or commercial service, and provides for the disclosure by a licensed attorney that legal representation may be undertaken on a contingency basis, does not constitute an inducement. Section 20 on the House is a new provision dealing with abandoned property. This would provide for a pay-per-performance contract with a vendor that vendor was awarded the contract could keep up to 7% of the value of property that was reunited with its lawful owner, not to exceed $500,000, and that the vendor trying to reunite property with its owner can't actually assess any charges or fees against the owner of abandoned property, and that this amount of money is a separate appropriation. It can't come from the value of the abandoned property. Section 21 requires a report on unclaimed property, and House Section 22 is the repealer of the bullion coin dealer program.
Beginning on the bottom of page R29, we have a number of Senate-only provisions. The first section, Section 16, deals with a public utility solar project at Camp Ripley. On the bottom of page R30, Section 17 is the pre-purchasing propane, the report. This is this language, or there were, Mr. Mueller mentioned that the cost for this report is contained in our bill, but there's some languages also contained in the Senate energy bill as well. On page R31, section 18 is would establish a task force on no-fault auto insurance issues, and this was I think was added in the finance division. On page R32, at the bottom of the page on section 19, is a section on the EITE rates, and this language is carried a few places as well in the Senate, and was some language similar but different than this was also just passed off the Senate floor today. So it is included here as well as in that bill that just passed today. That language continues on page R33 and R34, and that concludes the commerce section.
Any questions on Article 5? Seeing none, we'll keep going to Article 6.
Mr. Chair and members, the bulk of Article 6 is the same, and it's the recommendations of the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council, and we can go through these section by section if you want, or else we can just highlight the differences.
No. Ms. Newman, that's not necessary.
There are a couple of significant changes, however, or differences, however, Mr. Chair. On page R2, House Section 5 provides, it's the unemployment insurance tax reduction, which is based on the average high cost multiplier. That's one change, or one difference. And the second difference is on page R7, and this is the these are very similar provisions. This is for the trailing spouse provision, but the House has additional language beginning on line 114.16 on page R7 that says when making the determination of total wages and compensation, it has to include consideration of whether that is equal to or better than the applicant's employment, and differences in the cost of living have to be considered there.
And this provision, or this sentence, was discussed in the UI Advisory Council meeting that happened this spring, so it was something that everyone was made aware of.
And then, Mr. Chair and members, on page R11, House Section 17 is a House-only provision that reduces the unemployment taxes by $200 million in addition to any reduction that is contained with the average cost multiplier language. And there also is, we were informed, two provisions that the UI Advisory Council had recommended that didn't make it into either bill, and they came in late. So that's something that conference committee members can consider adding on.
Do we have that language? Has it been shared with the chairs yet?
Mr. Chair, I think it was actually in the separate bills.
It was included in the UI Advisory Council had a separate bill, but somehow it didn't make it into the governor's budget bill that this was included in, so we weren't necessarily tracking both bills and thought it was in there, so we do have the language.
Ms. Newman, can you just email me that language today? Thanks. And obviously, Senator Thomasoni as well.
Mr. Chairs and members of the conference committee, the next article is Article 9, Iron Range Resources. There is not a House article on Iron Range Resources. And I could go through all the various sections, but this is basically a technical and housekeeping, some changes to some names of some. Am I doing the right article?
Sure.
Senator Sparks.
Did we miss a delivered fuel?
Well, I'm wondering why. Right. So the next one that I have on my list is Article 7. Yeah. Delivered fuels. This is the propane stuff.
Well, Mr. Chairs, we could do this one, and then if you wanted to do all the energy articles at once, we could do that. It's whatever the chairs wish. I just couldn't start on this.
Let's just go to Article 7, because we just finished Article 6, correct? Yes, Article 7.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think when staff got the side-by-sides, the energy articles were the last, so that's why our articles are a little different from what you have in your binders.
Okay. So,
Mr. Eliff and I are going to switch out now.
Thank you. Mr. Eloff, please introduce yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chair and members, Bob Eloff with the House Research Department. Turning to Article 7, Delivered Fuels, it contains four definitions that are propane-related. It's Sections 1 through 3 and Section 5. On Section 4 on page R1, the last line on that page, 119.20, excludes propane storage facilities from the definition of large energy facility, and that has the consequence of excluding propane storage facilities from the requirement to obtain a certificate of need from the Public Utilities Commission before those facilities are constructed. And on page R2, Section 6, is the pre-purchasing propane report. It's the same language that Ms. Fontaine just spoke about that was in the Senate language, I think, two sections ago.
Mr. Chair, this is we just passed this off the Senate. Senate file 1735 today. Senator Skoy had an amendment on that, and that did pass the floor.
Wasn't Senator Skoy's the... His was the natural gas provision. This is the propane stuff. I think that those are two different provisions.
Yes, no.
Excuse
me, Mr. Chair and Senator Osmond. The Senator Skoy amendment was the natural gas extensions language.
Oh, that's right.
This was actually taken out of the... This was Senator Coonan's bill, and this was taken out because it was had a fiscal impact, and so the other propane sections went separately in the policy. So this is not included.
I stand corrected.
Please continue to... Any questions on Article 7? Article 8.
Article 8 on energy conservation. The first four sections of this article add sunset provisions of as of the end of next year, December 31st of 2016. The major provision is on page R3 in Section 4. That expiration pertains to the expiration for the Conservation Improvement Program that is run by the Department of Commerce. Back on R1, Section 1 also has the same expiration date for a section that allows cost recovery under that Conservation Improvement Program. And Section 2 also repeals a cost recovery provision regarding an incentive plan that pertains to the Conservation Improvement Program. And finally, Section 3 is an energy-saving policy goal, 1.5% a year, that is also tied to the sunset on the Energy Conservation Improvement Program. Section 5 creates new rebate programs for energy storage, solar thermal facilities, wind facilities, and also geothermal heat pump program. And those rebates are paid out of the Energy Fund account, which was discussed yesterday, and I'll get to later today. Moving to Section 7 on page R5, this establishes an advisory task force to examine different ways that conservation programs can be delivered by the state of Minnesota. And that report is due to the legislature at the beginning of next year, February 1st, 2016. Moving on to Article 9, Mr. Chair, on page R1, Section 1 has amendments dealing with definitions regarding solar energy in state buildings. Section 2 on page R2 is the establishment of the Energy Fund account. This is actually what we call the old Renewable Development Fund account, which to which contributions are made by Xcel Energy according to the number of casks that are stored at Monticello and Prairie Island containing nuclear waste. Those payments will continue to be made into this Energy Fund account. What is different is that the account is used now largely as a grant program for R&D on renewable energy sources. That language is stricken. Looking on the top of page R3 on line 127.22, it specifies that the monies in the renewable development account will be transferred to this new account except for amounts necessary to pay current programs. The 116C.7791 are existing solar incentives. 116C.7792 is Xcel's solar rewards program. And 216C.41 is the renewable energy production incentives that Minnesota has been paying to wind suppliers for almost 10 years now. The rest of page R3 and R4 is striking the old language in the renewable development account. On page R5, section 3 sunsets the Excel Solar Rewards Program after this year. Payments will be continued to be made to people who are registered in that program over a 10-year period, but no further applications will be accepted. Section 4 on page R5 makes changes to Minnesota's net metering law. The new language on lines 130.7 to 130.9 allows co-op associations and munis to charge additional fees to recover fixed costs that aren't recovered currently.
Mr. Liloff, if I could just interrupt you there, and I think generally speaking in the conference committee we are not going to be taking public testimony, but on this issue I know members of the conference committee have been receiving quite a few emails on the net metering reform positions that are in the House file. So is there any member of the public here who has concerns with that section of the bill who would like to provide an overview to that provision? Come on down, sir. You guys can just take a break for a couple of minutes. So. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the conference committee. My name is Lynn Hinkle. I'm a policy director for the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association. Our members have expressed concern about provisions that would provide a extra fee to co-op and muni customers. We think there's an opportunity to discuss this with other stakeholders to determine if there's a mechanism for determining penetration. I have to say, right from the beginning, MNCEA has been in dialogue with the co-ops and munis for years concerning net metering and their concerns about the ability to capture fixed cost. And this appears to be, one expression, one way that the co-ops and munis are trying to resolve this issue. We believe that there's an opportunity over the course of the next few days to meet with those stakeholders and discuss some alternative language that would be suitable for them. In particular, the idea that I just put forward about some triggering mechanism, penetration levels, to determine when and if certain fees would be available. We think there's a minimum fee approach that was discussed in the Senate this afternoon that has some merit. We also believe that there's an opportunity to look at providing a cap, if you will, so that we are fitting load to generation more effectively and preventing what would be called merchant systems. In the co-op and muni universe, that would be language that's very similar to language provisions for what's called 120% cap matching generation to load in other solar provisions in the current law. There's also a provision in current law that's very similar to what I was suggesting in terms of looking at aggregate penetration right now. For IOUs, that aggregate penetration is at 4%. At this point, I'm more interested in throwing out, providing some opportunities for ongoing discussion to resolve any issues with other stakeholders that we believe have a legitimate interest in looking at these issues and discussing them further and reaching a resolution that's mutually beneficial.
Mr. Henkel, so that was the Muni and co-op provision, but the correspondence we've been getting is more on the avoided cost side and those sections of the bill. Did you have any comments on that?
Well, we're concerned that for the net energy input, that would be a move away from the average retail rate that historically has been provided for whatever excess the net energy that has been provided to net metering customers. We think that's a step back, and we would urge that the committee spend a considerable amount of time deciding if you want to do something that is a repeal or a rollback of provisions that have been in law since 1981. We'd be the first state in the country that would be taking a position that uses avoided cost as opposed to the average retail rate for excess net metering consumption or production.
Mr. Engel, can
so
you?
So this is. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Continue.
It's a relatively complex, provision or set of provisions in the law. We think that this deserves some more time over the next few days as the conference committee looks at these issues, and we're happy to continue to be a part of that discussion and generate some possible solutions going forward. We realize that this is aimed at net energy input into the system, and that may not seem like a significant issue, but it is a significant issue to many of our ratepayers, many of our folks who are doing net metering. At the very least, it signals a significant shift away from how compensation has been developed in the past to a new way of computing that would use avoided cost. Avoided cost is roughly 2 to 3 cents. If you use the calculations using the standards that are in the provisions in the law right now, and when you compare that to residential rates of 11.5, some commercial rates are at the demand charge rate are in the range of 9.5. So you do the math, you can see that there's a fairly significant difference in what would be compensated to net metered customers for their net excess. So in other words, if you're getting two to three pennies, which is avoided cost versus 11.7 or 11.5 cents, you don't have to be a mathematician to understand that that's a pretty significant difference. Now, we also realize that there's some other provisions in this bill, and perhaps we don't want to talk about those at this point with a new incentive. I don't believe it's appropriate, nor, perhaps do you want to cover all of the provisions in this section, but that also adds some complications in, how we talk about this. I think it was a really interesting way to formulate the bill and give the chair credit for, trying to think out some ways to make net metering going forward work. We're concerned that stripping out the ability to use retail net metering is not the way to begin that process, but certainly we think there's some opportunities for us to dialogue with our friends and co-ops and munis about how to resolve their concerns about capturing fixed cost. Certainly one of the reasons that we did value of solar in 2013, and you all heard my presentation earlier this session when we were going through the entire net metering provisions about the value of solar, and it was our hope that we would find an alternative that would be suitable and beneficial to utilities in that formulation, and we still think there's some opportunities there, but in the meantime we think it's important to preserve some really fundamental characteristics of net metering in our state.
So, Mr. Henkel, under current law, when somebody has a distributed generation system and they are using more energy than their distributed generation system is producing, when they're in that situation, what is the compensation rate that the customer receives under current law? I mean, just for the net metering portion of it, excluding incentives, just...
Right, exactly.
What do they...
For the excess, what is net of what they use on site is paid at average retail rate. Now, there's two options, and if you go through the law, it's a little tricky walking through. Do you go to paragraph C or you go to paragraph D? But for both, the opportunity for paying average retail rate, or it's not an opportunity, it's part of the law. And that's the shift. That's what people are concerned about, and it may seem like it's minor, but it's the way people have approached net metering and have been able to find investments and move forward with these net metered facilities. If you look at what is actually going on in the state, and I don't want to take up the entire time this evening, although I love talking about this stuff, it's my life. If you look at how many, roughly 23 megawatts in 2014 were installed using net metering, and roughly 18 and a half megawatts of that was solar. The other portion, about roughly 7.5 megawatts, was small wind. So this isn't all just about solar. When you go through the process of looking at the percentages, and I've got the numbers back in my portfolio, but the penetration rates are on average 0.05, 0.056 percent across the entire range of utilities. That's co-ops, munis, and IOUs. There's a little difference between each of those utility categories. What is the penetration rate? But I get to that because I think the question I always ask when you look at legislation is, what are we fixing? And I'm not clear in this case what the crisis is, what is the penetration level that is driving this level of scrutiny on a process that, quite frankly, is, I guess, marginally at this point being used. I guess that depends on what you think is marginal, but by comparison to other energy sources, the amount of megawatts that are being put online as a result of net metering at this point.
So let me take a step back here, because I want to break up the individual transactions here. So in a situation where a person's distributed generation system is producing less generation than they are using, so everything's running, system based on time of day or it's not windy, under current law, what is that person compensated at with regards to their net metering? Explain what's happening to the meter and how that person is being compensated.
That's a really good question. The way myself and colleagues are reading this is that this law remains silent, that what people would be paid for that amount of load that's not in excess would be at average retail rate, the applicable, and the language is kind of confusing because it goes back and forth whether it's applicable retail rate or average, but either of those come essentially to the same place. There is a definition in here that explains what average retail rate is. There isn't necessarily a definition for applicable.
So in that situation where when a person is using more energy than they are creating on site,
right,
they are paid at the same rate under current law and under this provision. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And in a situation where a person is generating more electricity than they are using, and they're using the grid to store that electricity, and then they end up using that electricity later on, am I correct in saying that they are compensated the same way under current law as they are under this provision? Okay, so why is everybody freaking out and emailing us?
I may have been incorrect earlier when you asked me the earlier question about what was the under current law, you are paid the average retail rate, the applicable retail rate for the energy that you consume on site that you don't export to the grid, and you are paid the same applicable retail rate for the amount that is in excess of your load that you export to the grid. Under these provisions, that would change. You would continue to be paid the average retail rate for the amount that you use on site, but for the amount that is in excess of your load that you export to the grid, you would be paid avoided cost.
So if you export that load to the grid and then you use it later on that night, what are you compensated at under current law and under this proposal?
I'm not understanding your question, to be honest.
So we have a situation where a distributed generation system is producing more energy than this person is using. So they export that out to the grid. Then later on that night when the sun goes down and people turn their TV on and their microwave, they then pull that energy back into their system. Under current law and under this proposal, what are they being compensated at?
That's unclear.
Well, I can clear it up for you.
I think under one of the things that I think would be appropriate is for us to say that the net is calculated on a yearly basis. Other provisions in the solar law do that. I think it would be appropriate for us to look at how to calculate the net, because right now that is not clear. It's been assumed that it would follow year to year, year over year, but I believe that adding that language in provisions in this in-house file 843 would help clarify that. I think it would also be appropriate to, like I said, discuss what is load, so that there's a definition for that. It's spelled out in other statutes, and the solar law is 120% of your load. And the reason it's 120% is so somebody like yourself gets an electric vehicle. Your load increases. You don't want to penalize people that do those kinds of things or make modest increases in their small business, that type of thing, so that there's some flexibility in increasing your load, but not much.
Okay, so just to be clear here, just to, for members of the committee to understand, all the emails that you've been getting about net metering, when a person is generating less electricity than they're using, there is no change under this proposal versus current law. In addition, when a person takes that energy and they store it on the grid and they use it later in the month, there is no change under this proposal. And the only difference is that when a person is generating more electricity on an annual basis than they are using at their house, in other words, they are an energy producer, we are saying that they are going to be compensated in a different fashion. That third difference is the one difference for why you are getting all the emails you are receiving. And I just think it's important that members of the committee understand that perhaps the bark is not quite as big as the bite when it comes to this issue.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Ehlers.
I just might add that that's only for new systems that are put in place after the effective date of this act.
That is correct. So all those emails, just people know. So, Mr. Do you have any closing comments before we move on?
No, I appreciate your taking the time and giving me an opportunity to talk about the details of this, and I think it's appropriate for people to understand, accurately what is being discussed and what is being proposed. I do think that it represents, in the view of many people, a significant change away from compensation for net metered systems. It's a system that's worked well, like I said, for 30 years. And we think there are other ways, to work out how to deal with merchant systems and to establish a clear load to generation fit than setting up the changes that are being proposed in this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Engel. Mr. Eloff, if you want to continue with where you were at, I believe you were on. Was there any? Do we have other people who wish to testify? Sure, come on down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sarah Erickson, I represent DWEA, which is the Distributed Wind Energy Association. It's small wind under 40 kW. When you first unveiled your bill, Mr. Chair, first I'd like to say you did put an entire section in there for distributed energy, which is fantastic, so thank you for doing that. The one concern that that we have largely with the net metering provision is lines 130.7 to 130.9, and that would allow a co-op or electric association municipal utility to charge an additional fee to recover the remaining fixed costs. And I think everyone can agree that as technology moves forward, that co-ops and munis are going to continue to face a challenge where they have to continue to pay for their infrastructure fees. I think that's something we can all agree to. I think one of our big concerns is that there's really no guardrails on what this fee is, how much this fee would amount to, and I think that just kind of makes us nervous. I think that this is an area that we can come to agreement on with the co-ops. I think that there's definitely some middle ground, and I just wanted to get on the record and say that, and would appreciate the opportunity to continue to work on this provision as we move forward.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Grant, you're last. I mean, you're not last. You're the last one to testify today before we move on with the overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce. And we do have some concerns with these provisions. As you might recall, the department took it upon itself in 2012 to gather stakeholders together to talk about net metering and related distributed generation issues. And proposed legislation, which was adopted by this body in 2013, to reform net metering in a number of important ways. Partly the motivation for that was our ranking amongst states that have net metering provisions. There's roughly 40 of them that do. We were near dead last in terms of the amount of capacity that was being added through net metering, and we remain one of the lowest rates of penetration of net metered customers among those states that have net metering. Whether that's going to ramp up significantly under current law as it has been changed since 2013, we're still tracking those numbers to see, but we certainly hope it has that effect. The biggest concern we have with the provisions is the one mentioned by the last testifier, allowing a co-op or municipal association to assign a separate charge to a net metered customer. Since those types of utilities are not regulated by the Public Utilities Commission, we have a strong concern about how those rates would be derived, whether they would be discriminatory or not. We would certainly hope that you would consider another approach in that section. We also have a concern about making a change away from the method of payment for excess generation. This has been a longstanding practice in Minnesota. I think there are a number of customers who rely on that approach to finance their systems. I think there will be strong concern about moving away from that approach, and certainly we share that concern. There, I think, is a useful conversation would be around whether a size-to-load provision would address many of those concerns, and we're certainly open to discussing that with conference committee members and stakeholders. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd stand for any questions.
Commissioner, well, with the exception of Dakota Electric, does anyone regulate the rates of the munis and co-ops right now?
Mr. Chairman, their boards of directors do, or in the case of municipal associations, it's usually an arm within city government that does that.
So why would we treat charges differently?
Well, Mr. Chairman, my concern is that the methods that would be employed to assign those charges would be different across the board. Each of those boards can come up with a different approach to assigning what those rates should be, rather than with the regulated utilities that have one place to visit, and presumably the Public Utilities Commission would assign a uniform approach.
Any other questions from members of the committee? Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, to the commissioner.
your concern over the fixed costs, are you trying to say that the muties or the agencies that would be able to use this to recoup their costs would charge over the fixed costs that they're trying to recoup? Is that what your concern is?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Osmak, I'm concerned about what methodology they would be using to assign those fixed costs back to DG customers. Yes.
So, Senator Osmak. Chair, so, but they would be obviously calculating this so that they would only get their fixed costs so that they wouldn't gouge. I mean, you're not implying that they would find some way to gouge customers beyond their fixed costs, are you?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Osmak, I'm not trying to imply anything. I'm suggesting that we have 170-some-odd co-op and municipal utilities in this state, and that's a lot of different ways that this could end up being done.
Thank you. Any other questions from members of the committee? Thank you, Commissioner. Thank appreciate you. Your testimony. Mr. Eloff, back to where we were at.
Yes, Mr. Chair. On the bottom of page R6, section 5, continuing on to page R7, towards the bottom of page R7, there's language that strikes the requirement that the purchase price by the utility of excess energy generated by community solar gardens would be paid under the value of solar rate. The value of solar rate is repealed later in the bill. Moving on to page R8, towards the bottom of the page, the next few pages deal with changes that are made in our state's renewable energy standard, which is renamed the Advanced Energy Standard. The first change I'd like to draw your attention to is at the bottom of page R8, lines 133, 14, and 15, delete hydrogen as an eligible energy technology and include hydroelectric with a capacity of 100 megawatts or greater that is first placed into service at the beginning of this year and moving forward. Currently, the hydroelectric plants with that kind of capacity are not counted as part of the RES. Also, on page R9, lines 133.24 and 25, adds the storage of electricity as also a new eligible energy technology that can be counted towards the Advanced Energy Standard. On page R9, the striking of Subdivision 2 is language that referred to the eligible energy objectives, which were voluntary objectives before the Energy Standard came in, so that's just getting rid of some old language. On page R10, towards the bottom, language is stricken that pertained to Xcel Energy, exactly how what percentages of solar versus wind were required for it to meet its Advanced Energy Standard. But striking that language, it gives the utility more flexibility in meeting that standard. At the bottom of page R11 is a provision that was in a bill from Representative Neuberger, which says that if a utility reports that it's complying with the Advanced Energy Standard, caused it to raise its rates 2% or more annually, that the Public Utilities Commission shall delay by 3 years the achievement of its next Advanced Energy Standard. Moving now to R12, Subdivision 2F, the increase in the standard as a result of legislation passed in 2013 that created a solar energy standard, the 1.5% by 2020 is kept, but as you can see on page R13 at the bottom, page 137, line 20 and 21, that 1.5% can now be achieved by any other eligible energy technology in addition to solar. This section also strikes language requiring that 10% of retail electric sales in Minnesota be generated by solar energy by 2030.
Mr. Eloff, on that provision right there, the eligible energy technology, can you just point out to members of the committee where they can find out the list of eligible energy technologies?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The eligible energy technologies are listed on page R8 on lines 133.10, now extending to page R9, 133.25. Essentially solar, wind, hydro, and electricity storage and biomass.
Thank you.
The rest of the changes to the Advanced Energy Standard are just to take care of language changes that were made earlier. I'm moving now to page R16. At the top is striking language referring to CBED, the community-based energy development, which is repealed later in the bill. Section 7 on page R16 includes a new definition of repowering with respect to wind generation in terms of replacing aging turbines. And Section 8 on page R17 provides that the Made in Minnesota solar production incentives that were enacted in 2013 will continue to be to operate under the same statutes as were in existence at that time, but no further applications will be accepted after the effective date of this act for Made in Minnesota solar incentives. On page R18 in Section 9 is a new program that's funded from the Energy Fund account to provide solar incentives to facilities with a capacity no greater than 10 kilowatts. On page R19, section 11 in the middle of the page, requires large solar energy generating facilities, those that are 50 kilowatt or 50 megawatts or greater, to have surety bonds to in an amount sufficient to pay the cost of dismantling those systems and reclaiming the land when those systems are dismantled. It says the commission, the Public Utilities Commission, can approve an application for a certificate of need for those facilities until that surety bond is in the possession of the developer. Section 12 at the bottom of page 19 is from a bill from Representative Swedzinski, House File 1745, that pertains to the siting of large solar generating facilities. And this section specifies that if the plant is to be located on agricultural land, that in the environmental review document that's done before the project is constructed, analysis of the impact on the agricultural drainage system beneath the land be done. On page R20, paragraph D, on page 144, lines 10 through 16, also specifies that if it's a solar energy generating system, the environmental impact statement also include an analysis of how that reflected solar irradiance affects specific points nearby airports, air traffic, highways, and residences. On page R20 and extending to page R21, the change is on page R21. It requires the Public Utilities Commission, in making its decision on solar siting, to evaluate the impacts on local land use. The environmental review section 14 on the bottom of page 21 has the same language regarding agricultural drainage. There are two options that developers can choose in terms of siting solar plants, and this would apply to, I guess I'd call it, the less formal process that can be run by the Public Utilities Commission. On page R20 requires that before the Public Utilities Commission can issue a site permit for a solar generating system, all local permits must be granted, and a resolution approving its construction must be adopted by the local governing body where the project site is located. Towards the bottom of page R22, section 16, this refers to a provision that governed the term of solar and wind easements, which could be in place for a period of 8 years before operations had to commence. What this provision does is there's a current provision that sunsets that law in 2017. This bill would move that up to June 1st, 2016. At the very bottom of page R22, extending to page R23, is a provision that ensures that the Made in Minnesota rebates for solar thermal again, operate under the same laws that govern them previously, but again, no applications would be accepted after the effective date of this act. And on page R23 are a number of repealers. Those in paragraph A refer to several provisions that were enacted in 2007 regarding hydrogen, that the state government identify opportunities to deploy hydrogen technology, provide a list of pilot projects, et cetera. Those provisions are repealed. Paragraph B repeals the value of solar rate that I referred to earlier. Paragraph C repeals an appropriation from what was the old Renewable Development Fund to the university's Institute for Renewable Energy and Environment, which those appropriations stopped being made in 2011. Paragraphs D and E refer to repealing the sections of the Made in Minnesota solar incentive programs. And in paragraph F, section 216B.1612 is the seabed provision that is being repealed, excuse me. And 216C.39 is a rural wind develop revolving loan program that is being repealed.
All right. Well, Mr. Eliff, at that point, I think this is a good place for us to break for the day. Are there any questions or comments from members of the conference committee? Mr. Senator Tomasone?
Mr. Chairman, I'm fine with breaking for the day because it looks to me like the rest of the article, it's completely blank on the Senate side until we get to Article 9, which is then completely blank. Are we... Article 10, maybe? Article 9, it's completely blank on the House side, and then Article 10 is completely blank on the House side also. So there's not a lot for us to talk about in the next two articles, the next four articles. So this might be an appropriate place to break.
All right,
you
want
to finish them up and get them done with it?
Well, okay, we can finish up. I'm in an agreeable chair, you know me, but... Mr. Eliff, you want to?
Huh? Are they looking for us? No.
All right. I think what we're going to do is I think we're going to adjourn. We're going to stick with that. But I'm sure that the Senate's still in session. You guys get to avoid traffic. And
thanks.
Any other questions from anyone? So, Senator Tomasone, I assume we'll just.
So, tomorrow, I don't have any plans right now, so just watch your emails because if we decide to convene the conference committee again, we'll send out a half-hour or hour advisory so everybody can get here on time. So at this point in time, we'll talk and figure it out, okay?
Sounds good. And was the temperature better in the room today?
Yeah, in fact, I think that's a big reason why yesterday was boring and today wasn't quite as boring.
All right. Thank you, testifiers. Thank you, witnesses. With that, we are adjourned. Yeah.